leveling when everyone exists in this way, life goes on in an envious state. So instead of seeing people who do something excellent and then celebrating them with genuine passion, we kind of say, you know, I could have done that. You know, if I had made that decision, I know I could have done that. It's easy for people in a state of envy or in the world of leveling to say that, though, because they could have done anything, you know.
Can I try and articulate a very current example of this that I see quite often? Let me see if I can articulate. Maybe I'll get it through to you in the audience. Maybe I won't. But it kind of reminds me of it, which is when you go online a lot now, talk about the media a little bit within this concept, you know, and you see someone post about some famous individual, who generally speaking, especially if they're a bit older from a past age, this is really common, who was committed to some sort of passion or skill or whatever in their life, let's say musician, very famous, you know, and you'll see a post celebrating them in some kind of way. They're just posting an image or a famous song or whatever. You and I love to talk about the comments section. There's so much revealed there. The comments sections of these sections, I often find, rarely are celebrating the music, or let's say this, or the actor, whoever, the performance of some kind, the content. But generally, one of the most common things I see is moral jabs, right? People showing up and being like, oh, well, did you know in their personal life that they did X, right? Or actually they did Y, or they held this belief. And sometimes these are people who are like lived in like the 1950s, right? It's like, oh, you know, it's a while ago. But I find that interesting. And in a way, it's kind of reflective of what we have because, you know, first of all, people can't like just genuinely celebrate a piece of work. They have to, as you were talking earlier, I think one of the main positions that people take now is this position of like judgment, right? Rather than celebration or involvement. It's this sort of step back, kind of like what Kierkegaard was talking about in terms of like his own age with the press, where there was this proliferation of newspapers and periodicals and all this kind of stuff, where people would basically just critique and talk about, you know, other people and their works and what they're doing and all this kind of stuff, which, you know, obviously is fine and has its place. But it's very hard for people to almost like commit to enjoyment in a way. They always have to be in this sort of like standoff position of like, well, that might be a great song, but you know, they did this bad thing, right? I can never have 2 feet in the appreciation.
Yeah. Well, the reason for that is because if you enjoy it, that is a commitment to this pleasing you. Whereas if you want to enjoy something and commit yourself to it, you have to be a definite agent. But the agent, the person, the voice behind the press is an indefinitude. And that indefinitude is the public. Now, the public is not one person. It's not even a collection of people. It's just a kind of non-existent entity. And it's like a... I don't know how to describe it visually, but for example, Kierkegaard gives this example of someone who agrees with the public one day, and then tomorrow the public changes its opinion and boos that person. That one person stays the person they are because they made a decision, but the public is no different for adopting a different position because it's the public, and the public is a nobody. It is pure abstraction. So it gets to exist in every state that it happens to appear as through the press, and its kind of frame of reference for navigating the world is leveling. It's looking for things to chew up and spit out. He gives this great example or an illustration of, you know, a writer approaches someone, but that someone has a dog who just, they just sick him on him. And then he tears up his coat and, you know, tears up his shoes. And then the public's had enough. They've had fun tearing this person apart. And then they bring the dog back. And now that person is in shambles. But they invited them over, or they were appealing. The person came over to them. It doesn't matter. They can be whatever they want to be because they are an indefinitude. They're nothing. The public can be whatever it wants to be.
Yeah, I think you really articulated exactly what I was getting at. And that's such an interesting point. Something I didn't really think about is the incredible, I wanted to use the term flexibility, but I know there's a better term, of the public and how, like, as you say, it's never one thing.
Yeah.
Right?
Yeah, it's radically indefinite. It has no definite stance on anything. It's just whatever it is.
By representing everyone but you, effectively,
yeah,
it can be whatever it needs to be at any given time.
Yeah, and it's never accountable for itself because you can't summon the public for account. You can't accuse the public of anything. The public is just this pure abstraction.
And this is him talking about, the Danish publishing world in the 1860s, 1850s.
Yeah, no, and it's just all the more relevant now to things like social media or, you know, we love to talk about the comment sections of YouTube videos where, sure, okay, maybe there's like a username and someone had to log in to make that comment, but it's still the same kind of press mechanic where an amorphous being just kind of puts itself forward. It takes whatever stance it wants. You know, today the discourse is this, and this is what the opinion is. Well, the discourse is going to change, and now the opinion is this on whatever social media platform or whatever.
Well, and for, you know, speaking more about the media side of this very briefly, you know, in Kierkegaard's time, at the very least, an individual had to be like somewhat learned and connected to be a part of that public voice effectively. Whereas really, and Kierkegaard even then was talking about the sort of leveling out, obviously, of public opinion, of difference within society, right? And particularly leveling out of uniqueness and greatness and all these kind of things. But, you know, now really the public is potentially everyone. Like, you don't need to be some sort of special class. You don't need to have, you know, some sort of special education. You just have to have a relatively inexpensive device. And that's it.
Yeah, that's basically it. But let's move on to Heidegger and talk about, let's just introduce the concept of the they very quickly, which I think will be pretty simple now, given that these two notions, the herd and the public, have kind of prefaced what the they is. I'm sure a keen listener might be able to make a very accurate guess as to what the they is. But for the listeners, I will articulate it. So the they comes up in Heidegger's work, Being and Time, and it comes up when Heidegger is asking the question, who is Dasein? I mean, he's asking that question throughout the text, but specifically he's addressing it when he's asking, who is Dasein in relation to, I mean, anything really, but particularly others. And I should say too, if you're not familiar with the term Dasein, it is essentially the term that Heidegger gives to, he wouldn't like me saying the human subject, but us, our being, who we are when we are in the world, our being in the world, he would say. It's the German being there. It's who we are when we are there. Dasein isn't a what. That's, you know, we are humans and I'm a radio host and whatnot.
Dasein is sometimes, I think, accurately conceived as like who we are when we are somebody.
Mm-hmm.
Or I've heard another way explained by another philosopher was Dasein can be translated as, not directly, like indirectly, obviously, as here I am, !!
Yeah, that's a good way to put it.
Which probably isn't super helpful for our listeners, but if you're like familiar with the philosophy, it kind of makes sense.
Yeah. So in any case, Heidegger is asking, what relations does Dasein have in the world? And one of the relations is being with. And this is not, Heidegger makes this move a lot where he says it's not merely a spatio-temporal thing. It's a kind of experience that we have when we're in the world. So when I'm with someone, I'm existing kind of in nearness with them. I pervade the world with them. They're I'm concerned for them and I have a particular, my care for them takes a certain, it takes a certain form and whatnot. I think one of the more insightful things that Heidegger says in that particular section is that for Dasein, others are not who Dasein is not. So we have this idea of the other and we other people. The other is not some radical alien on the other side of an abyss.
Yeah, external entity.
Exactly.
Yeah.
The other is other people like us. So other philosophy students, other Canadians. People are my other insofar as they are me.
Yeah, I think for listeners, I mean, we don't want to get too deep into like the other kind of metaphysics of Heidegger, but it's important to kind of realize and think that I think one of the most revolutionary moves that Heidegger makes for me is this notion of breaking down this distinction that like the Cartesian distinction that I and you and everyone else is kind of this distinct internalized entity stuck in their heads.
Yeah.
Who's just like, you know, and everything else is sort of external to that sort of mental framework.
Yeah.
And instead he's trying to put forward the sort of idea that in fact, like we exist out in the world with other people. You know, I really love, he has an example of being with, you know, even when you're alone, right? Like even when you're alone walking through a forest, there's no one else around, you'd say, oh, well, you're not with other people then. But it's like other people created the path. Perhaps other people told you about this. You are going to this forest to be on your own from others, physically speaking. You're constantly in this sort of relationship pattern with other people.
Yeah. Heidegger brings it. So this is one way that Dasein exists in the world, but there's also the way that Dasein exists in its kind of everydayness that he talks about. The people who we're being when we are kind of ourselves, but not being our most authentic, our most concerned and most comported person in the world. And he says that the everyday self that Dasein is kind of determined by this indefinite social, and it's not social, but it's a relational force called the they. When we're born, we are born into a particular world that has particular ways of being in that world. And the they is more or less the existential experience of encountering those ways that one exists in the world. Any given way of being in the world in terms of relation, the they subsumes. So one goes to the store in a certain way, you know, you have to go, well, you know, you have to, if you go to a store, there's a certain decorum that is expected of you, and you experience that decorum. It is a phenomenological event, and the they is the one that enforces that event or that experience.
And I think this is a really interesting component of Heidegger's conception of the they or Das Man, the everyone, in comparison to Nietzsche and even Kierkegaard, although I think Kierkegaard gets a lot closer. And I have a strong feeling, as I remember back, that this Heidegger's concept draws strongly from Kierkegaard's Public.
Yeah.
But it is really, to emphasize to our listeners, that it is, in a sense, inescapable.
Mm-hmm.
But it's also not, doesn't have the same moral or ethical compunction that, you know, Nietzsche's Herd has, where it's kind of like, oh, you're stuck in this, you know, even the way Nietzsche frames it as like the herd, like, you know, you're this animal being dragged along with everyone else. But
yeah,
Heidegger, it's like, no, you're a human in the world with other people and you just can't escape that.
Yeah.
Right. Like, it doesn't matter how hard you try. Like, even thinking of an example, I think it's this example I've heard other philosophers use, talk about Heidegger. It's like, even if you're a hermit, even if you're someone who's like, I am going to leave my town, I'm going into the mountains, and I'm going to go and live there the rest of my life in a cave, and I'm never going to see another person again.
Yeah.
Even that person is still living their life in relationship to other people.
Absolutely, yeah.
The fact that they're retreating from society, retreating from others, is still a relationship.
Yeah.
They're still being influenced in who they are and how they comport themselves and what you know, their personhood is, that, you know, the formation of Dasein, in their case, you know, what that actually looks like is always in relation with other people.
Yeah. And that's the thing I noticed too with Heidegger, is this idea that it has a horizon and you can't escape the horizon that you exist in. I mean, Heidegger says explicitly, and this is one of the features of the they for him, is that the authentic self is a modification of the they self. When you exist as who you most authentically are, it's you kind of appropriating the way that you have been prescribed in the world and making it your own. Now, what's really interesting about this, so comparing Heidegger's notion of the they to Kierkegaard and Nietzsche's notions that anticipate it, and I think you're hitting on this in a certain way, is that Heidegger has made some innovations on the old ideas, and one of the ones that stands out the most is that for Nietzsche, herd morality is contingent. It is a contingent arising of, you know, the history of morals, and for Kierkegaard, the present age is not the age of revolution. You know, things could have been differently. There's a historical process that happens here. But for Heidegger, what's really interesting is that the they is constitutive of being with and being a self. You don't have an authentic self that isn't appropriated from givenness in the world. Heidegger has made what was a historical kind of errancy and a straying of history. He's made a constitutive element of being. And I think that goes to answer what you were bringing up earlier with this idea that it's really difficult to escape the, you know, contra Nietzsche, it's really difficult to escape the bounds that we found ourselves in. Okay, maybe I realize that morality is a, you know, it's a contingent offshoot of some kind of ressentiment that exists. It's just herd morality and I can overcome that. Heidegger would say, no, you can't. You can't overcome the they. You can become an authentic self, but it's always bounded and limited and determined by your they self.
Yeah, this is I do believe in a much earlier episode, you and I had a discussion on this, in relation to Heidegger, which was, you know, what is the factor of like self-realization within Heidegger's authenticity? It's debatable. It's something that like it seems like he shies away from, but then it's also like not really, I can't really see how it's workable without it. But it's this kind of like, there seems to be a component of Heidegger that where you kind of have to, if you want to be an authentic person, you kind of have to realize like, hey, I live within this particular horizon, in this particular situation, at this particular time, you know, given all that, who do I want to be, right? Like who am I? How am I going to figure myself out? And I remember listening to a talk with them. I forget the philosopher's name, the professor's name, but I believe he's at Cambridge. And he's basically says, like, you know, when someone comes to a place of authenticity, again, within the relationship of the they, never really escaping out, he says, like, you know, it doesn't mean that someone, you're suddenly going to live this way out lifestyle and you're going to go sell all your stuff and you're going to buy a sailboat and you're going to sail around the world, right? You know, that's like not what it's about. That's a fantasy and that's, you know, perhaps actually counterproductive. But instead, you know, if you're like a banker, if you're a bank teller, you're going to be a little more aware of your situation. You're going to be a little more familiar with your own mortality. You're going to be more in tune with, you know, both the robustness of the world that you live in and its fragility and its potential for change, right? And kind of really recognizing the effectively the structures that make up yourself and the relationships and world that you're in. But it doesn't mean that you're going to have some weird radical shift, right? Where you go and live off in the woods and just read books all the time.
You're going to be free spirit who reevaluates all values, you know, or you're not going to be, you know, you're not going to be a passionate person who sloughs off their reflection. I can just do things now. Truth is subjectivity and I know the truth, you know? Yeah.
Yeah. Which I think makes a lot of sense within the context of what Heidegger was saying. It's like, again, we go back to that point. It's like, you can't leave the they. You can't not be with others.
No, yeah, your right? existence like, right. in the world is a given, structured by this givenness, the they.
Yeah, it's how he says you're thrown into the world. You have a certain degree of thrownness. You just, you know, every day, even now, we think about in terms of like where you're born and those sorts of factors or whatever, the contingent factors of your life. But even now, it's like every day you wake up in a world of meaning that is kind of set. I don't like wake up and preemptively decide, okay, well, I'm going to be in this era with these people around me, living in this part of the world with this background, personal story, and this kind of internal narrative. You wake up every day with all of that kind of already there. And what are you going to make of it?
Yeah, well, I think the interesting thing here is that Heidegger does try to maintain some of the, and this is, I think this is the biggest way that Heidegger brings over one of the features of these two theories, and it's the indefinitude. So I think one of the interesting things about the concept of the they is he explains this weird phenomenon. Heidegger's notion of the they explains this weird phenomenon where, like, let's say you know, I'm sure you must have had this experience where you know someone and you know them well, you know their character, you know who they are, but one day they kind of stop. Well, it's not that they stop, but like they have this slip for a second. They stop being who they are, and they become just what they are embodying. So like, I don't know, let's just say like a stupid example of, let's say they're like a fan of
a waiter.
Sure. Yeah. They're a waiter.
The famous Star Trek waiter.
Yeah. The waiter. Yeah. You know who Tim is, but they just kind of fade into the background and they become waiter, you know, their personhood disappears for a second behind the veil of how a waiter ought to be. They are inauthentic in that moment. And I think that they helps to account for that because it's a non-being that one sort of falls into, but there is that capacity for interaction between, you know, genuine being and non-genuine being because they are more or less the same thing. They emerge, one emerges out of the other and one falls back into the other sometimes. So I find it and it has to do with Kierkegaard's notion of indefinitude, that the they is indefinite. When the they says one exists this way, the they could very easily say one exists the other way. You know, when you go to the store, you have to be dressed a certain way, but there are people who go to the store in their pajamas, and you know what? Are they really, you know, there are people who would say one goes to the store in their pajamas sometimes. Sure. It's not that big a deal. Well, maybe it is, but.
Well, it's interesting how even something as small as people, you know, people going to the store in their pajamas, obviously it's not a big deal. Who cares? But it is something that we notice, right? And that speaks to how ingrained our particular situation is within our, you know, worldly context for Heidegger and those sorts of relationships, where it's like, even if it's not something that, like, you know, anyone actually cares about or really values anyway, it's the kind of thing that, like, most people would actually pick up on.
Yeah.
As being odd.
They would bump up against that. Yeah. Yeah, absolutely.
Now, this is actually, as we kind of close out, this has been a controversy within Heidegger for a long time, which is particularly Nietzsche's conception of the herd. And I also think Kierkegaard's a bit too, but particularly Nietzsche's has a very moral conception to it. Heidegger's is confusing because at times it seems like he really values authenticity more as like almost in a moral position, but then constantly walks back from ever making that claim explicitly.
Well, you talk about explicitness. He does say when introducing certain concepts that he intuits will be taken, you know, as bad or something. He will say, I'm not making a value judgment here. This is just an articulate structure of Dasein. We're just doing the analytic of Dasein. And the they is a thing. Entanglement is a thing. You know, being lost in the they is being dispersed in the they is a thing. Leveling is a thing. I'm not judging here, but they're just things. But at the same time, I mean, he does try to articulate, you know, resoluteness as an endpoint towards action and this call of conscience, which one falls into or one finds oneself into or gets called to by one's ownness. So it is interesting, the valuation of the they is kind of, it's not clear.
No, it's not clear. And I know that, and I understand why Heidegger wants to get away from it, but it also leaves one asking, you know, like, well, if there is no moral valuation, then why not just be, you know, enmeshed in the they? And he talks about people who always talk as they do, who always live as they do, who think as they do, who have moral feelings just as they do. You know, he has this like long list in One Section of Being Time that kind of goes through that. It seems implicit in the work that that's not really how you want to be. That's not the best way to be. And one of the reasons he brings that up, which is very similar to Nietzsche, actually, and Kierkegaard as well, but especially Nietzsche, I think, in this case, which is this sort of leveling down of new ideas, of interesting stuff. And especially in, I think, our own era, you kind of see this trivialization of important things. That those who, that the they, and particularly those who are very much in the they, are susceptible to this, of everything becoming very, on the surface, interesting, but not stuff that actually people care about, right? Like, you know, the big new science discovery that changes the world is just another piece of news. The horrible tragedy that, you know, that happens on some other side of the world is just today's entertainment, right? And there's this kind of leveling down of basically the world and ideas.
Yeah, it's the leveling down of significance in the world, which he says is a real, it's a real articulate part of that. So I suppose that, yeah, if you took the analysis of world and you looked at the way that significance is leveled down by the they, I mean, that might be one way of finding a structural way for Heidegger to condemn being as the they. So, yeah, I think that's well said, though.
You know, I've really enjoyed the discussion today with you, Brandon.
Yeah.
I think it was really great. I really love this topic. I'm sure our audience did as well. I'm you know what? It's already got me thinking that there's more stuff we can kind of dig into on here.
Yeah.
But yeah, it's been wonderful. You've been listening to the Canadian Philosophy Show. And we hope you join us next time.
Please email us at hello@philosophyshow.ca. You can find the Canadian Philosophy Show at tcps.podbean.com and on Apple Podcasts and Spotify.
This is Bird Note. Does this bird seem to be saying Chicago, Chicago? Don't be misled. This small ground bird, the California quail, is strictly a bird of the far west. The California quail's gray and rusty colored body is beautifully adorned. And the most distinctive characteristic of this quail is a black forward-facing topknot that juts out from the bird's forehead like a small flag. Although quail can fly short distances, they spend most of their time on the ground foraging for food. When they're threatened, they scurry into thick brush. Quail build their well-concealed nests right on the ground, which can hold from 1 to 24 eggs. 24? Yes, the large clutches may include eggs from more than one female. Immediately after hatching, the chicks follow their parents around the neighborhood, scratching for food. Two or more quail families may join together to form a covey of quail. With such a large extended family, it's not surprising when a male California quail hops up onto a stump to gather the covey together with this rallying call. For Bird Note, I'm Mary McCann. Bird Note's newsletter delivers the wonder and joy of birds directly to your inbox. Sign up at birdnote.org to get a weekly preview of our shows, stories, photos, and more.
Trolling college music so you don't have to. No loyalties, no orthodoxy. Keeping it real, dumb, and organic since 2019. Tune into Home of Burnaby Rock with John on Fridays from 6 to 8 p.m.
Thank you for listening to CJSF 90.1 FM, broadcasting from Burnaby, BC. Take a look at our program lineup at cjsf.ca to discover the diverse range of contents we bring to you.